Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Special thanks to Visa for sponsoring today's podcast. Visa's dedicated to their vision of being the best way to pay and be paid everywhere. Worldwide, Visa has the capacity to process over 65,000 transaction messages every second. Visa helps you get to where you would like to be by making payments fast and easy, wherever, whenever. The only thing left to figure out is, where would you like to be? Visa. Everywhere you want to be.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to First Things First. I'm Jen Wolf. That is Chris Canty filling in for Chris Carter right here. Nick Wright. We have football last night. We have football this weekend. We have so much to talk about this morning. The Baltimore Ravens are not worried about the Patriots' top-ranked defense, or so they say. Carson Wentz isn't scared of Khalil Mack, but the 49ers did strike some fear in Arizona last night. That's where we start this morning. Jimmy G and the Niners taking on the Cardinals. So for weeks now, the story in San Francisco has been about how good this Niners defense is. Guess who got tired of that narrative? Jimmy Garoppolo. Garoppolo put together his best game of the season, 28 for 37, 317 yards. Four touchdowns. Niners get the win 28-25. They improve to a very perfect 8-0 on the season. Here's Jimmy G after the win.
8-0 is not going to get you anything, but it's a good start. And so we'll take the weekend to heal up, get some guys back, like you said, and make a run at this thing. I think we got a good group here. And so we got a long way to go, but we're on the right track.
Chris Canty, yesterday you sat in that seat right there, and I said, hey, listen, we're talking so much about the 49ers. We never even mentioned Jimmy Garoppolo. What gives? Well, last night, Jimmy Garoppolo heard probably everyone talking about how he perhaps didn't have a hand in the success of the Niners so far. How good are the Niners if Jimmy Garoppolo plays as well as he played last night?
Well, if he does what he did last night on a consistent basis, the 49ers are not only a team that's going to get to the postseason, but that's a team that can win some playoff games. I mean, he threw four career-high, four touchdown passes, was incredibly efficient last night.
Best game of the season.
Best game of the season. I mean, the 49ers offensively after those first two drives, they got it going. They reeled off three straight touchdown drives to end the half. Got an assist from Cliff Kingsbury at the end of that, calling the timeout right there at the goal line on fourth and goal. And then they ended up getting stopped, and then they get another opportunity and they punch it in. But I mean, Jimmy Garoppolo was outstanding last night. And then you saw why John Lynch traded for Emmanuel Sanders, because he was otherworldly last night in his performance. Being able to go for over 100 yards receiving on seven catches, I thought Shanahan did a great job in terms of his overall creativity and where he put Emmanuel Sanders, whether it was lining him up in stacks and bunches or putting him in the slot. He realized that Patrick Peterson was shadowing him in man coverage. And when you have a wide receiver in the slot, man-to-man, he's virtually impossible to guard because he's got a three-way go. But overall, this 49ers offense is going to be really explosive if Jimmy Garoppolo plays the way that he did, and then you get the production from Emmanuel Sanders and George Kittle.
And if people wanted to, prior to last night's game, make an excuse or at least an explanation for Jimmy Garoppolo's rather pedestrian, if not below average, stats, it would be, well, who are his weapons? Aside from George Kittle, who is an extraordinary tight end, I think most people believe one of the two best tight ends in football, he didn't have a reliable wide receiver. He appears to now have that in Emmanuel Sanders, and you saw the instant impact. He made a bigger impact yesterday than I thought he would make right out of the gate with a brand new team and a new offense, even if some of the principles are something he's used to. But to answer your question directly, Jenna, if Jimmy Garoppolo plays this well, this is the best team in football. Now, I don't know that he can continue playing this well, but if when we look at within the NFC, the three best teams, record-wise and I think eye test-wise, Niners, Packers, Saints, who has the best defense among the three? The Niners.
49ers.
Who has the best running game among the three? The 49ers. The question is, how much worse is the Niners passing game than one with Drew Brees and one with Aaron Rodgers? And up until last night, the answer was a hell of a lot worse. So much worse that people were concerned, are the Niners going to follow a script that we're very familiar with, which is the great defense, limited quarterback, very good regular season, flame out in the playoffs script. That was the script of the Chicago Bears last year. One could argue that was the script of the Jacksonville Jaguars a couple years ago. It was certainly the script of the Vikings in 2015 and damn near every Cincinnati Bengal playoff team that we'd seen during the Andy Dalton, Marvin Lewis era.
But is it that the offense isn't good enough, or is it that the jury's sort of still out on this quarterback? We just don't know how, because he hasn't really been tested.
Well,
the defense has really won their game.
Well, the defense and the running game. The offense, yeah. It's not that the offense, this wasn't the 2000 Ravens where you questioned all parts of their offense. Mm-hmm. This was a Niners team that could run the ball very, very well, and they had 9 touchdowns to 7 interceptions and a quarterback rating below average. Now, I don't think Jimmy G is going to be a 300-yard, 135 passer rating guy moving forward, but if he is just somewhere in the middle of where he was the first half of the year and where he was last night, that to me does elevate the Niners into the discussion right alongside, if not ahead of, the Packers and the Saints. I'm skeptical if this is duplicable against a better secondary and defense than what they have in Arizona, but if they can, then they check every single box of a championship caliber team.
Well, no, you're absolutely right, and that's what we're waiting to see, whether or not this offense can be as explosive against a better defense. I think the Arizona Cardinals defense is a low bar to clear.
Correct.
In terms of being able to judge the overall performance of what Jimmy G and his team could do. But in looking at the 49ers, you gotta love the fact that they've got 5 road wins before the calendar hits November.
Sure.
So as we move into the second half of the season, you got a lot of home games. I think they've got a 3-game homestand coming up with the Seahawks, Cardinals again, and then I think
Packers.
They have the Packers. So, I mean, this is a situation where it sets up pretty good for the 49ers. They've taken care of their business up until this point. Now they're starting to be in the conversation for teams that could potentially have a first-round bye when we get to January.
Go ahead.
I was just going to piggyback off the schedule point. We are going to get the answer to this question before the playoffs begin. They have 4 of their final 8 games are against, if everyone agrees, the 4 best teams in the NFC in some order or another are Niners and then Saints, Packers, Seahawks.
Mm-hmm.
Half of their remaining games are against the Saints, Packers, Seahawks. So we will be able to find out how good they are against better defenses, against the types of teams they will face in the postseason. But up to last night, the only question mark to me, because we haven't even talked about Kyle Shanahan and what a brilliant offensive mind he continues to prove to be, the only question was, how good is their passing game going to be? And last night it was exceptional.
So as we sit here November 1st, are the San Francisco 49ers the best team in the NFC?
I'm still not ready to crown them as the best team in the NFC just because I trust what I've seen from the Saints and the Packers, but that's in part because I know what their quarterbacks are going to be.
So this is all about quarterbacks.
From a week-in, week-out basis. Now, here's the other part about this. That 49ers defense didn't bring their A game last night. Now, I know it's a short week against a division opponent, but they came out and got punched in the mouth by that Cardinals offense on the first possession, and then you saw in the second half, Cliff Kingsbury used a little bit of tempo, standardized the defensive looks, didn't allow those guys to substitute and go to those exotic blitz packages. And that 49ers defense was reeling a little bit. So it'll be interesting to see whether or not teams around the NFL, other offenses, try to employ that strategy going up against that group. Because that's one of the better front sevens, if not the best front seven in all of football.
But I do find it really interesting to see the continued progression of Emmanuel Sanders and what he adds to this offense. In his whole season in Denver, which was 5 games, he had 14 catches, 180 yards. In 2 games in 5 days with San Francisco, he's got 11 catches for $140.
And there's a little of Kyle Shanahan in that, too.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. But it's also, no matter where you slot Jimmy Garoppolo, he's a hell of a lot better than the quarterback they had thrown to him in Denver and Joe Flacco. And for Emmanuel Sanders, for the first time since he had Peyton Manning throwing him the football, he has a legitimate NFL quarterback throwing him the football, and you're seeing him get back to, much quicker than I thought he could, the form of Emmanuel Sanders we're used to seeing.
When Kevin Durant and Draymond Green had an on-court altercation back in November during a Warriors loss to the Clippers, many just sort of filed it under teammates butting heads. But KD says that that argument carried more weight than most people know, and that it definitely played a role in his decision to leave the Warriors and ultimately land with the Nets. All right, Nick, this is really interesting. What do you make of all this, especially now that we know how this narrative played itself out?
Well, I'm glad Kevin Durant's being honest, finally. I mean, he says played a bigger role than most people knew. Man, there are some of us, and I understand right now, sports or otherwise, it's very in vogue to say the media is awful, the media is fake news, the media is the worst of everything. Sometimes we know things. And I'm not one that tries to defend the media, but sometimes we didn't all just get together and say, hey guys, let's start a conspiracy theory about Kevin Durant, mm-hmm. about his displeasure in mm-hmm. Golden State, about his rift with Draymond, and let's just pick a city, New York City. We were right on all of it. Mm-hmm. Now, I will admit, I had the team in New York City wrong, as a lot of people did, but we had been telling you ever since this argument that a relationship, this was a marriage that was already on the rocks, and then all of a sudden you check the phone and it's like, you've been texting with who? Okay, no, it's over. And we knew it was over. Now I applaud KD for being honest about it, and it's tough to kill Draymond too much for two reasons. One is Draymond always been this guy. KD knew he was this guy when he came there. And I don't know if KD comes there if Draymond is not recruiting him
right.
while he's on the Thunder.
Right.
So it's like, you know what I mean? If the person who brings you into a job is also the reason you get fired from the job, how much do you blame him if you wouldn't have gotten the job otherwise? Like, I don't know. But yes, I will give Kevin Durant credit for being more honest about this than he ever has been. Maybe now he feels he's finally able to because he's not on the team. And maybe Kevin Durant has the trauma of what happened to him on the court in the Western Conference, or in the NBA Finals, pardon me, has given him a maturity, or maybe given him, I don't want to say a peace, but mm-hmm. he's in a different place mentally than he was before. But obviously, you can't have someone call you what Draymond called him and say, we don't need you, we won without you, when that was already percolating in your brain, is that how they feel about me? And come back from that. It was the nuclear option. Draymond pressed the red button, mm-hmm. and he knew what the result would be, and Kevin Durant's now confirming it.
Yeah, I mean, fights among teammates happen. I mean, they're usually verbal. Sometimes they end up being physical altercations, yep. but there's always mutual respect there. But I think in this instance, KD feels like there was a line crossed and that Draymond Green, to a man, didn't respect him. Now, you go back to how all of this came together. I think this was a marriage born out of necessity because the Golden State Warriors, Draymond Green, Steph Curry, Klay Thompson, they wanted to keep this dynastic run pushing. And then KD, obviously, he knew that he needed some jewelry for his resume and ultimately his legacy. So when they came together some years back, it was something that was mutually beneficial. But I think that as it's run its course, as they won championships, and as KD got a finals MVP, he recognized that he was never going to get the credit that he was seeking in Golden State because the core of that team was already in place before he got there, and they had already won at the highest level. So I think he recognized that at some point he's going to have to branch off and start his own team where he is the focal point and the unquestioned leader in order to check the boxes that he wants to check and be in that conversation for all-time greats. I think he's already an all-time great. But when you look at these players nowadays, when you look at LeBron James and all of these guys, they're consumed with how they'll be remembered. And I think that that was the motivation for KD alongside with the rift with Draymond Green to leave this past summer.
You wonder if Draymond regrets any of it, just judging from where the Warriors are right now. But if you were the Warriors and your sole purpose moving into a new arena was to try to keep this core intact, or what I mean is try to keep KD there, what would you have done differently? If you're
the Warriors,
you knew what really happened.
They could have traded Draymond last year after this happened. And I know there were at least
would that
very,
have made it KD
No,
stay?
But that's the problem. The problem is KD was already, it's now been reported, KD, Kyrie, and DeAndre Jordan on a luxury ship in, you know, during the 2016 Rio Olympics all got together and said, it'd be really fun if we could play together one day. Mm-hmm. Not shockingly, a few weeks later, Kyrie, who a few weeks prior had talked about being so excited about extending his run with LeBron, he not only demands a trade, but says, I'll have knee surgery if you don't trade me. He is working his way out. Kevin Durant that summer decides to go with the Golden State Warriors, and then they all had their eyes on playing together in New York, one of the teams in New York, at some point in the future. Kevin Durant, I'm not the first person to say this, so it's not my take, but I think it's the correct take. He's a seeker. He's looking for what's next and looking for a level of fulfillment that he thought the championship would bring him. It did not. When you say it was out of necessity, now that is totally correct, because what the Warriors had realized was, man, this dude, LeBron James, he took a 6 when his second best teammate was Della Vadova, came back from 3-1 down on the best team we've ever had on a 73-win team. We need some help. And Kevin Durant's thinking, the team that just came back from 3-1 down on me lost to the guy who beat me in the finals, the first time I was in the finals. So they needed to come together to overcome what LeBron and Kyrie were doing out east. But it was always a shotgun marriage. And it was always, and people are going to kill Draymond. I know, Candy, the narrative is going to be, how many championships Draymond cost him? Because people think they wouldn't have lost in 2016 if Draymond doesn't punch at LeBron and get suspended. I think they would have anyway, but regardless. Mm-hmm. And now you lose Kevin Durant and the team's a mess. Okay, but Draymond got Draymond is the one that was recruiting Kevin Durant during the season. Draymond is the one that was tears in his eyes in the parking lot after they had lost to the Cavs, said, KD, we need you. If Draymond hadn't been all in on that, KD doesn't go there to begin with. So how much did he cost you? How much did he help you win? Those to me are part and parcel with the same conversation.
And here's the thing. It was a point of contention because from Draymond Green and the rest of those Golden State Warriors, they couldn't understand why Kevin Durant would leave a perfect basketball situation to go somewhere else. I mean, it's already a historically great team. Why would you leave that? The only reason that you would be for individual recognition. Yes. It wouldn't be for team goals. And I think that was the frustration from Draymond Green, who's the ultimate team player.
KD wants to be one of the greatest players ever. Right now, he's considered the third best player of his own era. LeBron, Steph, Durant. That's tough.
Yep. Back here, first things first, we are now joined by former All-Pro running back, Brian Westbrook. Good morning,
good
Brian.
Good morning.
Great to see you. Brian, we're talking about...
Come on now, get right now.
Come on, man. Come on now.
What just happened?
He has the biggest hands I've ever...
Little missed dap right there. It's all right. We got a bunch of segments with you.
He went aggressive. He went a little bit too aggressive.
I'm so glad that
we're here for 5 segments. We have 5 more chances for you to get that right.
That's on Kenny, man. The guy with
the bigger guy,
it's on him to sure the connection's not missed.
Sense.
Everybody knows the rules of dap, Candy.
Except I don't know the rules of dap. Brian, big weekend for the Philadelphia Eagles, a team that seems lost so far this season. Carson Wentz still searching for an identity for his 4-4 team, and the search won't get any easier against Khalil Mack and the Chicago Bears and that defense. But Wentz said the Eagles offense isn't, quote, afraid of former Defensive Player of the Year Khalil Mack. So, Brian, who's got the edge in this matchup?
You know, when I think about the game, I have to start on the defensive side of the ball for the Eagles. And, you know, they've gotten much more healthy. Fletcher Cox is getting healthy. Brandon Graham continues to play well. But more importantly, in their secondary, they got two of the starters back, Ronald Darby and Jalen Mills. And getting those two guys back is going to help this defense tremendously. And, again, you're facing Mitchell Trubisky, 5 touchdowns on the season. They have problems scoring the football in Chicago. And so when I look at the Eagles' defense, I give them the edge. But then you have to flip it over to the offensive side of the ball for the Eagles. And the big question, how do you slow down Khalil Mack? And there's a couple of different ways, and I would certainly want to run it by you. To slow down edge rushers, you run away from them, you double team them, or how about you just run the football? And that's something that the Eagles did a bunch last week, 41 times against the Buffalo Bills, and they were very successful with it with Miles Sanders. They were very successful with Jordan Howard. And so I think they should just try to do that. When you face a Bears defense that's going to get after the quarterback, run the football, the other thing you have to think about this Bears defense is simple. two of the last three games, they've given up over 150 yards rushing. They've given up over 150 yards rushing, which to me sounds kind of crazy when you're talking about one of the better defenses in the league. That's something that the Philadelphia Eagles can take advantage of. I think that's where they face, and that's where they start at offensively.
Well, the Eagles had a lot of success up in Buffalo running the football against a pretty good Buffalo front seven. So if they can continue to do that, I think that has to be their identity if they're going to have success on the offensive side of the ball and as a team, play keep away from the opposing offense and then being able to move the ball methodically down the field. But if you're going to do that, you can't have a lot of negative plays. And that's the one thing that concerns me about this Philadelphia Eagles team. Don't turn the football over. No negatives in terms of tackles for losses or sacks on your quarterback. That's the area that they've got to make sure that they take care of going up against the Chicago Bears team, because the only real path to victory for the Bears is if their defense is able to steal extra possessions and create short fields for Mitch Trubisky. You learned all you needed to know about how the Bears feel about their quarterback last week against the Chargers when they get the ball on the 21-yard line with 43 seconds left.
And a timeout.
And Matt Nagy runs the clock out and elects to kick that long field goal as opposed to trying to gain more yards and put Eddie Pinheiro in a better situation. I think he did that because he doesn't trust his quarterback. That's not going to change in a week. So correct. I think that's the biggest thing for the Eagles. Take care of the football, no negative plays, and you starve that Chicago Bears offense.
I love Matt Nagy as a play caller. I played against him in college, but not only did you not trust your quarterback, you didn't trust your running back that had a really good game last week. Hand the ball off to Montgomery, allow him to get 5, 6, 7 yards, make it
or
a shorter,
God forbid
a touchdown.
You don't
of course.
Have to kick the field goal.
You don't have to kick the field goal. That was just a bad coaching job last week.
Our friend from Lock It In, Cousin Sal, and in honor of tonight being Friday Night SmackDown, I'll use one of his lines, which is a wrestling line. This Bears-Eagles match is the old loser leaves town match. Where it is, the loser of this football game, you can just go ahead and cross them off. All year long with Philly, we've been like, well, can you cross them off given the division? If they can't take the game plan that was so successful against Buffalo and beat a Bears team that is ripping itself apart at the seams because there is so much talent, I actually still think Matt Nagy, even at the game management stuff, drove me crazy this weekend, does design an interesting offense, one of those Andy Reid folks, disciples, that... The fissure on that team is about the quarterback play and about how everything has to be done, keeping in mind, well, what can we trust our quarterback to do? I've got friends that do radio and media in Chicago. All week long, it has been, who are the best quarterbacks coming out of college? Should they go to Chase Daniel? This, if you lose to that Bears team coming off that type of loss where they're in last place in the NFC North, then guess what, Philly? You're not good. Like, we can say all this talent, all these expectations, only a half game. If you can't beat this Bears team this week, then you're just a bad football team. And what helps Philadelphia so much is exactly what you said. When you playing Buffalo and Chicago in back-to-back weeks is just a gift from the scheduling gods because they're built so similarly. They have so many similarities on the defensive side and on the offensive side, and you were just so successful against Buffalo. Now, I know Chicago's going to expect you to go do the same thing, but at least Philly has a second punch where, okay, you're going to sell out against stopping the run? No problem. We still have a Pro Bowl caliber quarterback back there that if we need to, we can go to the passing game. But that is, to me, if Philly loses this game, it's a wrap for them, which is one of the reasons why I don't think they will lose this
game. Chicago's the same team coming in. The Eagles get DeSean Jackson back. At least we assume they do. And that has to open up the game a little bit. How do you see that factoring into what the Eagles are going to be able to do?
Well, I think it certainly does open up the game. They haven't had DeSean Jackson healthy since week one. And so that's going to open up the field for everyone, Zach Ertz included, who hasn't had a very much impact all season.
Because there's been no real deep threat.
Absolutely. So they haven't had that. And so I think it opens up things. But here's the thing. In order to get the ball deep, you got to have a 5 to 7 step drop. And that's the danger territory against this defense, because those guys, we're running to that spot, that 5-step drop spot. That's where they're getting to on their pass rushes. So, again, I go right back to the run game. Because Chicago's not going to put up a lot of points offensively, you know that you can be much more patient with your run game if you're the Philadelphia Eagles. I would stick with that, and I wouldn't worry as much about getting the ball deep. I wouldn't worry about as much trying to get DeSean Jackson involved in the offenses early. We're going to run the football until they stop it, and once they dedicate 8, 9 guys to stop the run, then we'll take some shots down the football field and see where we go from there?
No, you're absolutely right. The game plan for the Eagles on offense has to start with developing a plan for Khalil Mack. But overall, I think this Eagles team has to start fast. This is the first game of a three-game homestand. It's an opportunity for them to gain some ground. They're already behind. They lost a head-to-head to the Dallas Cowboys. So they've got to build some momentum for their season. And if you're facing a team that's struggling in the Chicago Bears, if you start fast and get on them early, you continue to have that doubt with that Bears sideline. So I think this is a situation where if the Eagles handle their business in the first half, they can put this game away early.
And you mentioned the three-game homestand, but the next two are New England and Seattle. Yeah. So if you can't beat the Bears at home, the hell chance you have against those two teams. Right.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Ryan Westbrook, will the Browns save their season on Sunday? You know, could they also lose their season on Sunday?
They certainly could. I mean, this is their last chance. I think that, you know, you're playing against a football team in the Broncos that's getting a brand new quarterback in Brandon Allen. So you have a little bit of an advantage there. But it's really for the Browns. It's always been about the Browns. It's about how do you manage your expectations? How do you get ready for a football game? And can you get better week to week? And in the NFL, if you don't get better from week to week, then you're just going to be an average football team at the end of the day. And the Browns are below average. And so when you look at this team, first thing, discipline. Are they a disciplined football team? Absolutely not. They have 24 pre-snap penalties. That's just hard to do. That's fifth most in the NFL, 24 pre-snap penalties. First game of the season, 18 penalties. Last week against the Patriots, 13 penalties. So they're continuing to do the same thing over and over and over again, and they're not getting better. All three of those things, that's what get head coaches fired. Mm-hmm. So they have to find a better way to do it. Again, they have the ability to run the football. Don't put as much pressure on your quarterback. That's what I would be aiming to do. But at some point, you're going to have to throw the football down the field. That means Baker Mayfield is going to have to throw the ball to the guys in his jersey, not the opposing jersey. He leads the league in interceptions, not doing a very good job of taking care of the ball.
Yeah, the pre-snap penalties and the turnovers, those are all focus issues. And that's something, as a head coach, either you're coaching it that way or you're allowing it to happen. Either way, the results are it's going to be hard to win football games when you're doing that. I mean, if you're going to try to win games, you have to first do the things to avoid losing football games. And the Browns just have not been able to get out of their own way. And so looking at this matchup, I mean, the Cleveland Browns better be careful here. Like, it's easy to get up after a bye week knowing that you're going to play an undefeated Patriots team in Foxborough. But to have the attention to detail and the focus during the preparation to go play a 2-6 Denver Broncos team, it might not be as crispy, might not be as sharp. And this Denver Broncos team has had a lot of clubs on the ropes. It's just things late in games don't typically go their way. But the Denver Broncos are a sack safety by Von Miller away from getting a win in Indy. And I think we would all agree the Indianapolis Colts are a pretty good football team.
Or just a missed Adam Vinatieri field goal.
That's right.
Exactly. Vinatieri's got to kick a field goal at the gun from 50-plus, or the Broncos win that game.
Exactly. So, I mean, the Cleveland Browns have to be careful with this one because, Nick, you said this earlier, they can't save their season with this win, but if they lose this game on Sunday, their season is over.
Right. That's exactly correct. There is no way to save it this week, but it can die this week because we need to talk about what they've done the last month. Because week four, they beat Baltimore. And it's like, okay, Baltimore had just lost to Kansas City. They lose to Cleveland. And it's like, oh, all right. So we're tied for first in the division. In fact, they were in first in the division because of the tiebreaker. What have they done since then? They go to San Francisco on national television and get annihilated, embarrassed in that football game. They play Seattle and blow a 2-score lead. And then when they have a chance to come back and salvage the game, Baker throws a pick on that final drive. They then have a week to prepare, because they have a bye week for New England. How does that game start? Here's the first four drives. Three and out, turnover, turnover, turnover. You mentioned earlier when we were talking about Baltimore, John Harbaugh's record after the bye. Mm-hmm. Andy Reid famously has an outstanding record after the bye. Bill Belichick's got a great record under all circumstances, but particularly after the bye. The best coaches have their teams extra prepared. Sean McVay, when he has extra time, whether it be a Thursday night game, beginning of a season, after a bye, going into this year, the only game he had lost in those circumstances were against Bill Belichick, actually going. The best coaches in football get you ready to go. The Browns played, I thought, actually pretty well in that football game, mm-hmm. except for the first quarter where they lost the football game. So now you play Denver, a team who is right now got to feel as sick about where they are as anybody in football, because they're 2-6, but they are 3 field goals in the final 30 seconds of games away from being 5-3, away from being tied with the Chiefs for first place in the AFC West. If you can't beat that team, with Brandon Allen taking his first career snaps, if you can't at least salvage this portion of the season a little bit, then yeah, Freddie Kitchens is like, is he coaching for his job? He is. Not because they'll fire him 9 games,
at
8
the
games.
End of the season, or do you think he's coaching for his job after this game?
Well, so I do not think John Dorsey is going to fire a first-year head coach inside of his first year. I do think if they lose this game, their season is over. And if this season is an abject disaster, Freddie Kitchens can sign his head coach death certificate, if you will, with a loss this weekend. Now, it won't actually be delivered until the first week of January. But if they lose this game, I would wager any amount of money he is not the head coach week one of the 2020 season.
A big part of an offensive coach's job is to make sure that your quarterback, your young quarterback, progresses and gets better year
yes.
after year. Baker Mayfield has not gotten better. Actually, he's gotten worse. And so this football team and Freddie Kitchens' job in particular certainly is in big concern, because their quarterback and their play has not gotten better. But the talent around them has. And that's more of a bigger problem, because the expectations were high. And right now what they've been delivering has been very, very low.
Listen, remember at the beginning, you know, in the offseason when they were looking for a head coach after what happened last year, one of the names that was brought up was Mike McCarthy's name, who's been in the league many years, who understands what discipline is, who's not going to allow pre-snap penalties and turnovers and sloppy play and all of it. But they instead went with someone who Baker felt very comfortable with, who probably Baker put great words into John Dorsey for. And you see that that's not really working out. Would the other way have been better? Is it that the team needed more discipline, or are the players equally to blame as Freddie Kitchens?
Well, I listened to all the comments from Baker Mayfield, and maybe he needs a coach, either an offensive coordinator or a quarterback coach, that's going to be disciplined with him.
And not
that's going to hold him accountable. That's going to say, listen, this is not okay. Don't pitch the ball to the other team. If you see the color, hold on to the football. If your guy is double teamed, throw it to the guys in your jersey, or just throw it away. Maybe they need to find a guy that's going to be more disciplined. And if you look at this roster, up down on the offensive and defensive side of the ball, they have a bunch of talent, but discipline has been the issue throughout the entire the Freddie Kitchens era in Cleveland. That's going to be a problem for him as far as the head coaching job.
Well, yeah, here's the thing. Just because you're a good position coach or a good coordinator doesn't mean you're going to be a good head coach, because it's not like you're just responsible for Baker Mayfield and his development, but you're responsible for developing a culture on an entire football team. And that's the one question mark that we haven't gotten an answer from Freddie Kitchens so far. And if we continue to have that be a question mark, eventually the answer is going to be no. He's not capable of setting the agenda for this team. He's not capable of providing leadership for a young locker room. And so that was one of the concerns coming into this season, how this team would handle adversity and who they would turn to when things got bumpy. Because BW noticed in an NFL season, you're going to go through some things as a team. It's not going to all go according to plan. And it's how you respond that's going to determine whether or not you have a successful season. So far, the Cleveland Browns have failed at responding in the right way. And if they don't respond this weekend in Mile High Stadium, this season will be considered a failure.
Mike McCarthy is not the guy they should have hired, even if he would have been better than Freddie Kitchens. Bruce Arians is the guy they should have hired. Now, I don't know. Seems like Bruce really wanted to coach Tampa. For some reason or another, it seemed like that's what he was targeting.
Maybe weather's a lot better in Tampa.
Weather's a lot better. And maybe he believed in Jameis to a way that I don't necessarily believe in Jameis, or whatever it was. There wasn't a lot of talk about Cleveland hiring Bruce Arians. I'm just simply saying he's an offensive mind who also brings a level of accountability. Right now, I'm very confident saying of the 8 coaches who were hired this offseason, some are unknowns. There are 2 where the team hired the wrong guy. Adam Gase with the New York Jets and Freddie Kitchens with the Cleveland Browns. Now, Zach Taylor's 0-8, but I don't know if he's the wrong guy or not. That team might just be so bereft of talent, and you're retooling it. The Browns made the wrong decision. Now, if they turn it around, he will get a year two. But at some point, before Baker gets his second contract in this league, he's going to be on his third head coach in this league. And that's not even counting the interim head coach in Greg Williams. And I feel like we know that 7 games in.
Thank you for listening to the First Things First podcast. Remember, leave us a review and tell us what you think. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and catch us on FS1 Monday through Friday, 6:30 a.m. Eastern. For Chris Carter and Nick Wright, I'm Jenna Wolf. So long, everybody.